The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Tánaiste Leo Varadkar, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks. Thanks for having me, Pat. Hope to see you in person one of these days, not in the not too distant future.
Yeah, one of these days. We'll just await our shots and then we'll be ready to go. And I can't wait, to be quite honest. It's pleasant looking out on the blue skies.
I won't ask you to reveal your age, but I imagine you'll be able to book your appointment in the next week.
Yep, that's hopefully the way it's going to go. And then the second one, and that's something we'll talk about, whether or not the spacing of vaccines might be appropriate. But first on the agenda today is something non-COVID related, except indirectly. And that is the question of the move towards not a minimum wage, because we've got that already, but a living wage. You've made moves to progress that. Explain your reasoning.
Sure. Well, I think the pandemic has changed a lot of things, and one of the things that's changed is the way we see and the way we value the work that people do. And I think it's actually caused us to redefine what we think of when we think of a frontline worker, an essential worker. And I know when I was a kid, when I was growing up, when you thought of a frontline worker or an essential worker, you thought of a nurse or a doctor or a guard or a paramedic, an ambulance crew. People who are public sector, secure, pensionable jobs, relatively well paid, or at least paid higher than the average or median. But I think now and more, we think of other people too. We think of retail workers, we think of delivery drivers, we think of cleaners. That really is an essential service, and food service as well. And these are often people who are in low pay, who are in secure jobs, who are in insecure jobs, and are generally in the private sector. And one of the things that I want to do, and the government wants to do, is to make sure that there's a pandemic dividend, that we have a better a society and a stronger economy after all of this. And that means raising the floor for all workers. It means rewarding work. It means ensuring that work pays. And, the kind of things we're doing, for example, is extending parental leave. That was just done the last few weeks by Minister Gorman. I'm working on introducing sick pay this year, a move to a living wage starting next year, and auto-enrolment, so everyone has a pension, everyone who's working has a pension in addition to the state pension, starting in 2023. So when it comes to the living wage piece, I've commissioned the Low Pay Commission to examine and develop proposals for a living wage for Ireland. Now, a living wage is something that everyone's in favour of. How could anyone be against it? But as is often the case when people are, when everyone's in favour of something, it's because it means different things to different people. And it is all about the model. So the model in Britain and Northern Ireland actually has a living wage that's lower than our national minimum wage. And we're not going to do that, obviously. There's a model based on what's called a MESL, which is a minimal standard of living that people need to be able to fund. There's a model based on a percentage of median income. So we need to work out the right model for Ireland. We need to work out whether we're going to bring it in overnight or phase it in. We need to work out whether there should be exceptions for certain workers and certain businesses who mightn't be able to pay. They're the kind of things that we need to work out. But we're going that work is now being commissioned by the Low Pay Commission. Or I've commissioned it, and the Low Pay Commission is going to do that over the next little while.
Yeah. Now, there are a couple of elements here. It is normal that, young workers get paid less than workers who are a little more experienced in their jobs. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is. And there's a kind of a logic to it that you may not have the same responsibilities at a young age that you may have later on. So would a living wage, therefore, have to be age-related, experience-related? Might it even have to be location related? Because certainly the cost of living in Dublin would be greater than the cost of living in Leitrim.
Yeah, well, they're all, I have opinions on those things, and they're all the kind of things that we're going to need to tease out. And that's part of the work that I've commissioned, and we'll be very interested to hear people's views on this, employers, unions, members of the public. The way the minimum wage works at the moment is that there are different rates for younger people. The living wage in the UK doesn't kick in, I think, until you're about 23. So that's the kind of thing we need to consider. There is an argument, I think, in a higher rate for Dublin, given that the cost cost of living is higher in Dublin. But that's also fraught with difficulty too, you know, because there are people who live in Dublin but work outside of Dublin. Where do you draw the line? Is it the county boundary? Is it Leixlip or Greystones? Who knows? So those things are very complicated to get right, but they're all certainly open to consideration. But there is one thing I do need to say, and there will be business people and employers listening to this, and, you know, they'll be worried. They'll be wondering how they're going to, deal with this. They're facing a pandemic, Brexit, high costs, reduced revenues. And, you know, an assurance I want to give them is that we're going to do this right. We're going to phase these things in the right way, and we're going to consult with them. Because if we do this wrong, it actually won't work for anyone. If you bring in higher wages and improved terms and conditions, and they result in people losing their jobs or businesses closing or hours being cut, then you've actually made things worse for everyone. So, I'll be approaching this from a non-ideological point of view, and it'll be a partnership with unions and business and workers, and that's the best way to get it right.
People might be surprised that Leah Varadkar, the patron saint of those who, quote-unquote, get up early in the morning, might be moving along particular lines towards do you know what I mean? You accept that they might be surprised that it's your party that is moving this?
Yeah, they might be surprised because they probably pay too much attention to what my opponents say about me. Like, these are exactly the people who get up early in the morning. Retail workers, delivery drivers, cleaners, people who work in hospitality and food service, and these are the kind of people I've been talking about all along. And let's not forget that I've been a member of a government that increased the minimum wage by 25%. It's one of the highest minimum wages in the world, at least in cash terms. We have signed up to public sector pay deals that reversed the cuts that were made to people's pay back in back during the financial crisis. As Minister for Social Protection, I brought in paternity leave, paternity benefit, brought in new social protections for the self-employed. So, this is a continuation and acceleration of an agenda that I've always been committed to, which is rewarding work and ensuring work pays. And, you know, I let other people do the virtue signalling and ideology, and I'll just get things done.
Some of the other initiatives, the right to disconnect, for example, and that's a promise. It's not been totally teased out yet, and the right maybe to work from home or to demand to work from home. You could characterize what you've been proposing now as being, you know, the worker's friend. And there are cynics out there. I don't think I'm among them, but I still put the question, are you trying to steal some of Sinn Féin's clothes before the next election?
And again, just look at what Sinn Féin does in the north. I doubt anyone would want to exchange the pay and terms and conditions that we have here for what they have north of the border. The only thing that's better north of the border, really, when it comes to terms and conditions and so on, would be sick pay. And that's something that I'm going to deal with and intend to deal with this year, because they have statutory sick pay in the north. We don't here, but we certainly have higher wages and better social protections, certainly through the social insurance system. So there are two Sinn Féins, as you know, but let's leave that for another day. I think it is about a vision about how a society and how an economy should work. And it's very much the position of the government, not just a personal position. And we believe that we can build a better and a fairer society by raising the floor for everyone, by making sure that there's a threshold of decency below which nobody falls. And in the round, that actually will be better for the economy, because people will be less likely to have to fall back on the state for other needs and other costs. They'll be more able to afford the rent, more able perhaps to buy their own home if they've better pay and more secure jobs and better terms and conditions if they can afford to pay into their own pension fund. But we do need to get it right, though. I often say Ireland is not a country that is wealthy because of our gold or diamonds or our oil or gas. You know, we're wealthy because of the goods and services we produce and sell overseas. And that's why we have to stay competitive as well. And it is about getting that balance right. It's not about left versus right or unions versus employers or goodies versus baddies. You have to look at things in the round. You have to do the numbers and you have to get it right.
Yeah. Now, in many of the international companies, there's no union representation. There is in some. What about the right to be represented by a union? Where do you stand on that?
Well, you do, of course, have the right to join a union, but it's not required under Irish law that your employer has to engage with that union or negotiate with that union. And that's in our constitution. You know, there's the right to associate, but there's also the right to say that I don't want to associate. But you know, things are I think developing on that front. There is a European directive coming down the line which will encourage governments to promote collective bargaining. And also there are some court cases that I don't want to say too much about, but there are some court cases at the moment that are challenging some wage setting structures that we have, particularly in low-paid sectors. So what I've done there is I've appointed a group. It'll let you meet, I think, for the first time tomorrow, a group on collective bargaining, again, chaired by an independent person, an academic from Maynooth, but with employers and unions represented on it. And that's going to explore our industrial relations legal aspect and our legal landscape and come up with some recommendations for me.
All right, but the Constitution would be a bar to saying to employers, you've got to talk to the union.
It's not necessarily a bar because, you know, we do have wage setting structures in some low paid sectors, you know, where there is poor union density, where there's a committee essentially made up of a government committee, if you like, made up of employers and unions under the aegis of the Labour Court that can set minimum terms and conditions that are particular to a sector and are higher than the national minimum wage. So it's not an absolute thing. So you know, there are things that can be done, I suppose, within the Constitution. We have to define that. But bear in mind, the approach that we've already had and always had in Ireland is a volunteerist one. It's one where unions and employers can negotiate and can come to an agreement, but agreements can't be imposed on them. The model that you have in other countries often does give people very strong rights to be represented by a union, but also gives the government and the equivalent of the Labour Court very strong rights to adjudicate on disputes. You know, so it's not just a case of giving people the right to be represented by a union. In a lot of countries, the right to strike and the right to take industrial action is actually limited at the same time by legal mechanisms like the Labour Court, which would then issue binding recommendations to sort out a dispute and to end a strike. And that would be a big change, you know, so the two do kind of go together, actually. And that hasn't been enough
now,
part of the debate. So
going back to the process, because that's what it'll be, towards a living wage. One of the elements that people are wondering about is when you're calculating the wage, you think that's what's paid by your employer. But in this jurisdiction, there are lots of helps for people. The social welfare code, the HAP system, for example, with the help to pay rents and so on. Would that form part of the calculation of the minimum wage, in a sense, the amount of money that people get into their pockets, whether it's paid for by the state or whether it's paid for by the employer?
Yeah, that does depend on the model that we go for. So a very simple model is just to set a percentage of the median wage, and we just say that, you know, everyone should earn 60%, at least 60%, or at least 66% of the median wage, you know, something like that. Very straightforward, very easy to calculate, and also make sure that the number of working people who experience poverty would then be very low and even lower than it is now. So that's a simple way of doing it. An alternative way of doing it is what they call the minimum acceptable standard of living, which works out, you know, how much a single adult would need to earn, you know, to get by and have a decent standard of living. And of course, then you have to take into account both costs, like housing costs, for example, childcare costs, or if you decide to include that, or then also the extent to which those things are subsidised by the state. And one thing I think we do need to bear in mind in Ireland, even though we have a high minimum wage in cash terms, when you adjust it for the cost of living and purchase power, it's actually lower. It's actually lower than in the UK at the moment, which people might be surprised to hear. And that's a reflection of the fact that a lot of people on low pay in Britain would get things for free that we have to pay for here, for example, the cost of healthcare. So you do need to take all those things into the round if you go for that MESL model, which is a more complicated one. But this is interesting stuff, and I probably sound like a terrible policy wonk going on with these types of things, but this is the journey that we're now on, and this is the kind of work that I have now commissioned from the Low Pay Commission and intend to begin the introduction of the living wage in Ireland next year.
begin the introduction there too, yeah. kind of tentative things begin yeah, number yeah, no, one well, and the introduction number two. As I say, it's a process. I mean, will it be fully in place by the time of the next election?
But the commitment in the programme for government is to do it during the period of this government. So, you know, if this government goes to full term, the answer to that is yes. I do think it is something that would need to be phased in, not too long a period, but over a number of years, you know, because we do need to accept the real and genuine challenges that some businesses would have in increasing wages, particularly in the current economic environment. And I don't want to do anything that actually is counterproductive, that causes people to lose their job or causes them to have their hours cut. You know, nobody would want that. So I think it will need to be phased in, but the commitment is to do it during the course of this government. That's a commitment I intend to honour.
You know, they say hard cases make bad law. I've a text here from one of our News Talk listeners, Deirdre. I was self-employed and lost my job due to COVID. Before COVID, therefore no PUP payment. I'm married, so not entitled to any social welfare payment due to my husband's wages, and I'm not allowed to sign for credits because of my self-employed stamp. I don't exist in the system statistically. What's being done to help people like me, because I need to protect my pension? As I say, hard cases make bad law, but there are all sorts of anomalies that crop up.
Well, if that person wants to contact me directly, I'd be happy to look into that, because actually one of the things we changed in the last year or so is that people who are self-employed do qualify for job seekers benefit on the same basis as people who are employed. And that was one of the changes that I started as Minister for Social Protection, and Regina Doherty completed it. Because we had this terrible unfairness of people who were paying PRSI for years and years and years, then when they lost their jobs, they didn't get job seekers benefit because their spouse had an income, and that's actually changed. So there may be more to that than the detail we're being given.
We can put Deirdre in touch with your office.
Please.
Now, on to vaccine matters. I heard you say on radio the other day that you would take the AstraZeneca vaccine. You've no issues with it at all, even though quite clearly you're not over 60. What do you make of what's been going for AstraZeneca, Denmark abandoning it entirely?
The only country that I'm aware of that's done that so far, and that's going to slow down their vaccination program, and there'll be consequences to that, because you know, the facts are clear. You know, I have the NIAC advice in front of me, and you know, when it comes to any vaccine or any medicine, there are side effects, and some of them can be serious. But you have to ask the question: is it safer to take this vaccine than to not take it? And for somebody aged between 60 and 64, they're 85 times more likely to die as a result of COVID than to have an adverse clotting event. And even for somebody, you know, in their 50s, they're 23 to 48 times more likely to suffer an adverse outcome as a consequence of COVID as opposed to the vaccine. So, you know, that they're pretty good odds in my book. And one of the things that starts today is the portal is now open. People aged between 65 and 69 can register for their appointment for their vaccine. And over the course of the next week or two, we'll extend that to everyone over 60. So, you know, there is good news today for people who are who are over 60 and haven't had the vaccine yet. They'll be able to make their appointment over the course of the next week.
Do you maintain your stance that you'd take AstraZeneca if you were offered it today?
Yeah, I do. It's slightly more marginal for my age group. In my age group, you're six times more likely to suffer an adverse event as a result of COVID than from taking the vaccine. So, you know, 6-1, if I was offered it, I would go for it. But at the moment, we're prioritising people who are over 60. And that's the right thing to do, because they're, of course, at much higher risk of COVID than people in their 40s like me.
Now, a phone call came through during the cabinet meeting from Ursula von der Leyen's office saying great news about extra quantities of Pfizer, which would be 540,000 doses if you say it's a two-dose vaccine. However it's spread out, whether it's 4 weeks or longer, it's 270,000 people. It doesn't quite make up the loss if Johnson & Johnson goes. But then later in the day from Ursula von der Leyen's office, we hear they're not going to be renewing a contract with AstraZeneca next year. They're going to concentrate on the mRNA vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna. I just felt it was just so damaging to AstraZeneca's reputation and brand and Oxford and so on. And that if it slows down programs in places like Denmark, in Ireland, wherever, that inevitably it'll cost lives. Why that breaking news yesterday? Why was it necessary to make those kind of statements?
Yeah, I can't really speak for the European Commission on that. I do think some of the messaging that's come out from the European Commission and some other European capitals, not from Ireland, in relation to AstraZeneca hasn't been particularly helpful. You know, we have four vaccines that are licensed now in Ireland. All four of them achieve close to 100% protection in terms of prevention of death and severe illness. You know, these are really effective vaccines. I think it's not helpful for any authority, whether it's in Brussels or any other European capital, to be, downplaying the efficacy or safety of any vaccine, because, you know, they are safe. And this is a pandemic and it is a race against time to vaccinate as many people as possible. And if we slow that process down deliberately through our own actions, more people will get COVID and more people will die of COVID and more people will get an adverse reaction or an adverse result because of COVID. But, you know, having said that, I do think one thing that probably will happen, and this is changing all the time, but bear in mind, is that when people are getting their booster doses, and we think probably people will probably need booster doses, maybe in the winter, maybe every winter, that they are more likely to be mRNA vaccines than viral vector vaccines. But who knows, Pat? You know, like... We may yet find out that the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine wear off quicker. You know, like we just don't know these things. You know, this is a new virus and these are new vaccines. While it may on the face of it now look as though the mRNA vaccines, which is Pfizer, Moderna, are the best or the most effective, we might find out that they're the ones that wear off quicker. You just don't know. And the best thing we can do at the moment is to take whatever vaccine we're given and do so knowing that the benefits outweighed the risk 10 times over, if not more, and that it's going to protect us against this very nasty virus.
I listened to the Minister for Health yesterday, Stephen Donnelly, talking on The Hard Shoulder about the discussions that are ongoing about spacing out the vaccines more, looking to do maybe a little bit like the UK has done, which is get one shot in the arm of as many people as possible and then start doing the second shot. What's your thinking as a medical person who understands more about the vaccines than I would? What's your thinking on that possible strategy?
Yeah, I'm interested in hearing the arguments on that, and I know you've Luke O'Neill on later, who's an advocate of this, and he's generally proven right about most things when it comes to the pandemic. So I'll be interested to hear what he has to say later on. And, you know, the one thing I would say is that for people who've already been vaccinated, who've already received their first dose, I think we should stick to the plan for them. They are generally the people who are most at risk, so that's why it makes sense to have them fully vaccinated. And also, they've been given a date already for their second vaccine, and it could be very disruptive to the program if we start changing those dates. But perhaps for people under 60 who haven't yet been vaccinated, who are in good health, it might make sense for that group to delay the interval between the first and second dose. But there are, you know, there are pros and cons to this, and things look great in the UK at the moment. But what they're doing in the UK at the moment is also an experiment. You know, they're opening their country up pretty quickly at a time when they've half vaccinated half their population, and might look different in 3 or 4 weeks' time. I hope it doesn't, by the way. I hope what they're doing is right. But, I don't think we should just assume. We've learned so many times in this pandemic that a country that appears to be doing well now might look very different in 4 or 5 weeks' time. And, you know,
as
I'm happy enough to let that experience
ourselves
play out a bit more in England before we go down that route.
I mean, we were great, in November, and then suddenly Indeed. In January and February we're in a terrible state. But it brings me to the logical question based on what you said about the UK, and they've opened up to some clamour in places like Leeds. You've probably seen the brawling outside the pubs in Leeds. But if the UK opens up, including Northern Ireland, we'll have the situation where, you know, in Black Line you can walk across the bridge and have a pint in Northern Ireland, whereas you couldn't do so in the south. Go and get your hair done, in Derry when you can't get it done in Letterkenny. I mean, that's going to be an issue.
It is. And, you know, as things stand, as you know, travel within and out of the state, including Northern Ireland, for a non-essential purpose against the law. But of course, in the real world, are those kind of laws enforceable in border regions? And they're probably not, because those communities are very integrated. And And that's a good thing. We may even have a more complicated scenario, like one scenario I could envisage later in the summer, perhaps in July and August, is people flying into Belfast to get around our quarantine rules. They'd be acting illegally in doing so, but again, enforceability would be a huge issue. And we could see a repeat of last summer where Northern Ireland takes a much more liberal approach to travel than we do. And we'd have people flying into Northern Ireland for tourism purposes and people flying out of Northern Ireland for purposes of tourism, you know, really undermining anything that we're trying to do here when it comes to quarantine. But, you know, that's the reality of what we're dealing with. Ireland is an island geographically, but politically, economically, socially, we're not.
Some of the questions and comments coming in from Newstalk listeners. One saying, what about Valneva, the French vaccine that's been manufactured and will be in Scotland? It's giving total protection, not just a bit of the spike, but the whole of the virus. Do you have any information as to whether the EU is pursuing Valneva, which might come on stream before the end of the year, and would be the one? Because we were a bit slow off the mark in terms of the other vaccines, as you know.
Yeah, I have to double check that one because I do sometimes get them mixed up. There's Valneva and there's CureVac and there's Novavax, yeah,
Valneva is the one Boris Johnson went on a political visit to Scotland. And where did he go? He visited the Valneva factory and a few weeks later they ordered millions of doses. So yeah. I'm just wondering, can we get ahead of the game as well?
Yeah, but I checked that out. I'm not sure, to be honest, and I don't want to give you misinformation. But there's one thing I would say, you know, let's be careful about talking about game changer vaccines. You know, I remember when the AstraZeneca vaccine was going to be the game changer one because it was easy to transport, much more so than Pfizer, Moderna, which have to be kept very cold. I heard about the Johnson vaccine being the game changer because it was single shot. Now that's been suspended. You know, this is still an evolving area and we're still learning a new virus, new vaccines. And that is one of the reasons why we're being maybe overcautious or abundantly cautious when it comes to some of these rules and regulations and changes. And I think that's on balance the correct thing to do.
Yeah. Now, the final question I'll ask you to respond to, and it's really a reflection of lots of texts we're getting from News Talk listeners, and it's about, you know, pitching one age group against another age group. You know, one age group gets AstraZeneca, another group gets Pfizer, and all of this kind of thing. But the fear factor, one text which exemplifies everything, how do I tell my mum, who is 69 and is scared to death, to take AstraZeneca? She says, maybe I'll wait until August when I'm 70 and then I'll get the golden vaccine of Pfizer. Now, you know, August is a long way away and there could be a lot of infection around before August. What do you say to that woman and what should she say in turn to her mother?
Well, you know, I think when it comes to these things, it's always important to listen to people's concerns, to take them seriously, and to answer any questions that they have. And, you know, my experience as a doctor more so than as a politician is that when you give people the facts and you give them to them honestly, they generally make the right decision, and you respect whatever decision they made. And, you know, like I say, when it comes to the AstraZeneca vaccine, there is no doubt whatsoever that the benefits of receiving that vaccine outweigh the risks manifold. The risk of getting COVID and getting sick from COVID is much greater. And when it comes to any medicine we take or any vaccine we take, that is the assessment. Do the risks outweigh the benefits, or rather do the benefits outweigh the risks? And they do, and they do, they do manifold. You know, no vaccine, including the Pfizer one, is without without its risks. But I do think there's one thing that maybe has come across wrong. I hear people saying that the AstraZeneca vaccine is only for people between 60 and 69. That's not correct. It's anyone above 60. So there are 500,000 people above 60 who haven't yet been vaccinated. We can now offer them appointments through the portal, which is now open within the next week. And even for people under 60, they will still be getting AstraZeneca. In some cases, it'll be the second dose. In other cases, the vaccine can be made available where the benefits outweigh the risks and the person consents to the risks. So, you know, this is a vaccine we're going to still be using.
Is it possible then, finally, that when the portal is up and running properly and it's open to all comers, that people can say, I'll take AstraZeneca if it's available tomorrow, if I have to wait till August for Pfizer? No, I'm 45 or whatever. I'll take my chances. I'll sign a disclaimer. Is that a possibility?
Not yet. We're not at that point. I don't rule that out, but we're not at that point yet. You know, we have about 860,000 AstraZeneca vaccines arriving in this quarter, Q2. That's April, May, and June. We've about 500,000 people over 60 have yet to be vaccinated. We have the second doses, so you know, we will make use of that vaccine. Our supplies of that vaccine this quarter, maybe down the line, if we find out that you know, we've extra availability of one vaccine and a shortage of the other, that we might give that consideration. But that's not for now. That's I think for a few weeks away.
Tánaiste Liam Radcar, thank you very much for giving us your time this morning. Thanks a million.